welcome to episode 21 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I talked to Mike Arnold. Mike reached out to me in response to a tweet I posted saying I was looking for guests, and especially college professors and math teachers. Mike is a math tutor, and in fact runs his own tutoring business, Arnold Tutoring, and has recently started a professorship in Ontario, Canada. Mike and I talk about the problems with math, how it should be taught, and ways we need to rethink math education, how hard work should be rewarded much like a final product, the importance of keeping the tone at the top, and how we should make students not stress too much about exams. There are some weird audio issues in Mike's recording. I'm not really sure what caused it, but I'm looking in to make sure it doesn't happen again. So you won't notice it in the recording, but there are a few spots where I lost some of what he said, so it's a little choppy occasionally. And I'm sorry about that. I think it is still understandable completely though, so it's still worth the listen. Also, don't forget that there is 1 week left to enter my t-shirt giveaway contest. Just to go to bradtreffler.com/feedback and leave an iTunes review or a Flipgrid comment about the show and you'll be entered to win. Winner will be announced at the end of the show next week. But for now, sit back and enjoy episode 21, my interview with Mike Arnold. Hi, everybody. Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. I am joined today by Mike Arnold, a math tutor and a math professor as well in Toronto. And yeah, so hi, Mark. How's it going?
Hey, how's it going? It's going very well. Thanks a lot for having me, Brad. This is exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to have you. I was telling you before we recorded, you're the first person to reach out to me and ask to be on the show. And I think you're also my first math person, which I've commented on previous episodes is unlikely to happen often because I'm not a humongous math fan. So, but I wanted to get a new opinion, so that worked out.
All right, maybe this will be the start of many, right?
Maybe that's what'll happen. I don't think so. I don't think so. all right, cool. Well, Mike, tell me a little bit about you and what you're doing, what you're up to these days, or tell my audience, I should say, a little bit about who you
sure,
are.
Sure, sounds good. Yeah, so not the most exciting thing in the world, but they basically deal with financial risk management normally for insurance companies. So it's the classic, like, oh, you meet an actuary at a party and you ask him or her, do you know when I'm going to die, sort of thing. So they're tasked with pricing life insurance and other products for insurance companies. So that's sort of the education background I have. But over the last 5 years, I've left that insurance world, and I started a company called Arnold Tutoring. Very creative name, just went with my last name. And that's a math-focused tutoring company based out of Toronto, Ontario in Canada. And we, you know, do everything from one-on-one private tutoring for all grade levels. So we have students as young as grade one and as old as, you know, calculus three in university, as well as sort of group seminars, small group classes. We just try and customize it kind of to our clients. So I would call us sort of a boutique service in that sense. And over the last 18 months, we have launched an app called AT Now that tries to connect students with tutors and sort of works to knock down, you know, barriers like financial barriers or geographic barriers that often wouldn't allow certain students to access high quality math tutoring. So that's sort of a short intro there. And the way I found your podcast is because we're based in Ontario. I got to know Stephen Hurley, who runs Voice Ed, and I saw your name on there a couple times, and then the magic of Twitter kind of did the rest.
Yeah, absolutely, very yeah. Cool. Well, you know, I'm definitely glad to have you on. You're doing a college professorship as well, so that is another little piece
yes.
there. So you have that side of it. So between that and math are two demographics I said I really haven't been hitting, and you hit two of them. So that worked out
yeah,
really
that,
well.
I guess that was the actual tweet that I answered to. That's right, about being a college or university professor up here in Canada. So I've just had a little bit of experience with that, which was fantastic, and I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's cool. Like I said before we recorded, it's interesting your path that you went from actuarial, position, which typically is a pretty high paying job. I mean, actuaries do really well in my experience. Is that correct?
Yeah,
typically?
No, very, very well, especially kind of at a young age. If you can get through some of the professional exams that you have to write at a fairly young age, you're definitely making a good salary. I was actually working in the U.S. at the time too.
Okay. Where out in the U.S.?
In Connecticut. So Hartford is kind of like the insurance capital of the world. So there's a lot of actuaries there.
Oh. I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun fact about Hartford, Connecticut.
The only fun fact about Hartford.
That's true. It's not a long list. but you're exactly right. It's actually been ranked many times, not just by like Actuary Magazine, but by like Forbes as the number one job in the world. It's consistently up there in the top three or four jobs in the world based on stress and income and things like that. So yeah, good career.
Yeah. You know, and I will say as someone who's not a math fan, when you introduce your own profession as not all that exciting, and now you tell me there's an actuary magazine, I cannot imagine a more boring read. I just can't.
It's a short magazine. I'll send you my next coffee, Brad.
Okay, thanks. Good. Yeah. Riveting. I sometimes have problems falling asleep, so that'll be useful. That's good. I did tell you before I was going to try to limit the math jokes, but I have not done a good job so far.
Plenty of time left. Don't worry.
All right. So you went from, but I liked it that you went from sort of actuary to entrepreneur, which my background is in business administration and my degree's in entrepreneurship. So I'm definitely, I've done a couple of businesses here and there, and arguably running a podcast to me is very much an entrepreneurial experience. So I have a lot of connection there, and I just love that you went into an entrepreneur role that was so educationally minded, if that's the way to phrase that.
That's a great point. Something I probably didn't think too much about. And the reason the tutoring came to be and that we had this idea for sort of stirring for a couple of years before we actually made the leap and quit our corporate jobs, is that that was sort of my, part-time job when I was going through university. That's all I did for work. I had a pretty good network of teachers that I knew from my high school and my community, and they would refer me a lot of students, helped a lot of first-year and second-year university students as I was in my later years. And, it was a good job. Found I had a, pretty big passion for connecting with students, delivering math material, which is not always delivered in the best way, I don't think. I thought I was decent at it. And when you're decent at something and you're kind of passionate about it, why not go for it? But to your point, not really knowing anything about the inner workings of an education system, that for sure I overlooked.
Yeah. You mentioned your business partner is your sister.
Correct.
Yeah, and did she have a background in education?
Nope, also a business degree.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's interesting. It's very cool. So, and I definitely can't disagree with you in the idea that math is often taught in a not ideal way. I'm certainly not informed enough to say what the right way is, but I know as a student, I certainly never found interest in it, and I don't feel that the majority of my students now find a lot of value in what they're being taught in their math classes. Mm. And not through any fault of the individual teachers, but of the system as a whole, I believe.
Yeah. What grade are you teaching?
High school.
Okay.
So I'm kind of all over high school.
Got it. Yeah.
So what is it we're doing wrong in math? What is it that you see as being the problem in teaching and how we teach math?
Yeah, that's a big question, because I think people's first reaction is to go to that question that I'm sure every math teacher's got is, when am I going to use this in my real life? and for the majority of careers, I would say directly and never use it again. So I think the beauty of math is the same beauty that's in a card game, which is solving problems, dealing with the unknown. So you don't know what card is going to come out of the deck next. But there's math around all of that process that, without maybe thinking, it's, you know, stamped with a math stamp. That game is fun for that exact reason. So we're just trying to fill in that gap of like, okay, how do we put some actual science and reasoning behind the fact that it's exciting? You don't know what that next card is. So I think it's more about showing students that they're solving problems in math class rather than they need to know what sine of 30 degrees is.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, I feel like even in my own experiences, the classes I was, you know, I've told the story before, I think, but the one class I remember loving math was, I think it was geometry or no, it was probably algebra. I take it back. It was my first algebra class because we had graphing calculators, and I quickly became obsessed with the graphing calculator. And it wasn't that I was interested in the math. It was that I was fascinated by making programs for a TI-86 that would do the math for me. And I turned the math into a problem that I could solve. And that was what drove me in that class. And of course also led to a lifelong obsession with technology, but but that was what I loved, was the problem solving side. It wasn't memorizing the formulas. It wasn't remembering that the negative goes there and to find a common denominator and any of that kind of stuff. It was, there's a problem. I want to make this thing do this thing. It just happened to be math stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's following steps to get to a desired outcome. Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that's big. And you hit the nail on the head there, which I think is the biggest challenge we were sort of chatting about before, but is if you find a kid or a student that is sort of interested in something with a little bit of whether it be logic or problem solving or critical thinking around it, you should try and latch on to that. And I think what we can all do better as educators is embrace hard work a little bit more rather than hard work for the specific outcome that's going to get the report card grade, if that makes sense. So, you know, you, in your case, if you're rewarded and encouraged as much as the kid who's doing all the worksheets of fractions when you're working on coding a TI-86, that's a much better outcome, I think, for everyone, right? You're going to work harder on something you're excited about. They're going to work harder on something. You'll both be, have higher levels of ability at the end of it. Whether they tie perfectly together to like a quote curriculum or not, that probably doesn't matter as much in the long run.
And you're hitting on like ideas of differentiation as well too, which we've shown is tremendously effective. And in my scenario, the one thing I will say, and I don't remember the teacher's name, but I do remember distinctly she had a rule with the TI-86s. You had to pull if you pulled the batteries out, all your programs you wrote were stored in RAM. So as soon as you pulled the battery out, everything you wrote was gone. And she would always make us do that before a test so that we didn't have any programs on our calculators. And I remember going up to her and going, "Hey, I'm writing all these programs. Like, I'm not just copying them from someone. They're mine. I'm making them. The reason they work is because I figured out how to make them work. Shouldn't I get to use them on the test in that case? Like, I totally get not giving them to my friends, but shouldn't I get to use them?" And she kind of thought about it, and she, like, said, "Well, let me see what you're doing." And, like, I showed her the code and how it worked and everything, and she goes, "Yeah, that seems totally fair.
That's so
you should
awesome.
Get to do that."
That's so awesome.
And it's like, I don't know that every math teacher on my campus, or at least every math teacher I've interacted with in my district, I don't know that all of them would do that. I think a lot of times many teachers, not just math teachers, but many teachers would get stuck in this fairness vein of, well, that's not equal. If you can't, doesn't matter that you're writing it, no one uses that on the test.
Yeah, totally. Math people were pretty, pretty rules based, right? and so I'm sure the snap answer would be saying, no, it doesn't matter, but that's super cool that she did that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you're right. So I think if we can find a way to bring that engagement and that interest without getting to the math and then later getting to the math, maybe that would be a better way. You know, finding more problem-based where they are actually solving problems, not just word problems that are prose versions yeah. of equations, but like actual real-world problem solving. I think we could really engage kids.
The math aside, for as long as you can. So one of the big things that we always say, now it's a little bit different when we see students because they've generally seen the topic once. Sometimes we're teaching ahead, but let's say they've come back from a class on whatever it might be. Let's say derivatives, even if it's a calculus student, right? And so the best thing I think to do is just to sit back, like put the pencil down and just say, okay, well, tell me about this thing. Like, what's a derivative? What did you learn before that? Why was that important in leading up to it? Talk to me about it in your own words. And obviously certain units in math allow for a better discussion around that than others. But I think whenever a student can sort of talk about something in real terms or how they might apply to the real world, that means they're understanding it or at least they're engaged a little bit better. And that will help them, you know, with the more advanced questions anyways. So I like talking about, even though, of course, the best way to get better at math is to do math, I do think there's some value in actually talking about it and kind of taking a step back with a student to see what sort of depth of understanding they have.
Well, and I think especially in your case where you're tutoring, the majority of those that you're tutoring are probably not math-minded people. They're not people that are going to become actuaries because they would already have a passion for the material to begin with, and in most cases I would say that passion would drive them to self-study and self-apply versus needing to see a tutor and get additional help because they're not comprehending the material. So I think especially in your case that's hypercritical that you're engaging them in ways that are not what they're already seeing in the classroom.
Yep, totally.
Cool. Well, Mike, I'm going to go ahead and move into my first question, and we may have already kind of touched on it, but I'm going to move into it anyways. And my first question for you is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Thought you might ask this. that's a good question. That is a big question. Again, I don't want to ever come down on teachers. I think you guys have the hardest jobs in the world. And I'm not even one myself aside from at the university level, which is definitely a little bit different. But I would say, I think where hard work and, you know, grit or passion is not properly rewarded, I'll say. I'm trying to pick my words carefully here. And what I mean by that is we now live in a world where, you know, as it's said on pretty much every education podcast, you can Google the answer to anything information-based, right? But by the same token, it's also never been easier to start a business or you know, create an online community. We basically live in a world where you don't need permission from anyone to start anything. And that alone should be something that's brought into the attitude of educators, I think, while students are still in school. So if you take the mind of a 15-year-old kid, right? Maybe all he cares about is eventually becoming a YouTube star or an Instagram influencer. He's super excited about all the sneakers he's bought or something. I'm completely making this up. But how are we going to put somebody like that through sort of a funneled, prescribed education system? That's never going to work. It's not going to be a good outcome for anyone. So how do we, I guess, reward somebody who's clearly passionate about something and is hardworking, how do we make them not feel discouraged, I guess, by education? That's what I would say. So in aligning kind of an evaluation or reward system with hard work as much as, you know, knowing your unit circle.
So
I'll give you one last example in there. I always say I think
yeah, absolutely.
I think forget the YouTube star thing, but I think we should be encouraging and applauding students who are trying to be good at math, just as much, if not more, than the students who are already showing they're good at math. And the reason.
Okay, so that was kind of going to be my follow up. There is, do we need to negate the celebration of those who just sort of naturally get it, or do we need to maybe find more of a balanced approach? And I think there's a fairly obvious answer, but I'm curious where you fall.
Yeah, and I think therein lies the difficult part of being a teacher, right? Is because, okay, well, do we come down and help those students who are really trying hard but are clearly not getting it, they're going to need a little bit more time? Well, then you maybe aren't pushing the advanced students far enough. And I know myself, looking back on the education I had, I was very lucky. I was always, you know, pretty much top of the class in math class, and I had got the ability to be in advanced placement classes and probably with the best teachers who would push us further. And I'm very grateful for that. But at the same time, once you're out in the real world, which is the question that students start to ask at a younger and younger age, now that they have a better sense of what the real world is, the true game changer is hard work and perseverance, right? So if you're a C student who's worked their butt off to get up to become a B student and really have a pretty decent understanding, that should be applauded just as much as the student who's cruised along with A's the whole time. And I don't know what that exact evaluation looks like, but not only encouragement, because I think teachers probably do a good job of encouraging hard work, but the actual rewarding for true hard work and grit and perseverance, those things that we know matter in the real world, that's, I think, the biggest miss in the classroom right now.
Okay. I think about your case where you were very math-minded and you ended up in business school, and then you went into entrepreneurship, and you went into a field that you weren't necessarily an expert in. I mean, you went into education, which, while you had been a student, was not your expertise, but you learned those things because of the thing driving you. And I think from a student perspective, I think often that's the problem with math, is we're forcing everyone to learn all the same math.
Sure.
And it may or may not, and in most cases does not, apply to anything they're interested in. You know, and the whole real world, everyone balances a checkbook thing. Well, no, they don't. And I had an adult say that to me when I was doing an adult class the other night. And I made a usual math joke about how pointless it is. And they were like, well, have you ever balanced a checkbook? I was like, no, why would I do that? I can check my bank statement instantly at any time. Why would I don't even write checks.
Right.
What, my checkbook balance is always blank. What is a check? I don't even know. Like so many of the things we use to try to tie real world value to math are, first of all, mostly multiplication, addition, and subtraction, and division. And beyond that, they all are these sort of like arbitrary fringe case examples that some system or website can probably do for us at this point. And so I think it gets harder and harder for those weak real world examples to be valid. And we need to be looking at, sort of like you're saying, finding ways to celebrate the students who are trying and pushing them and their interests towards, and then when their interests intersect with math, maybe that's where we need to push.
Yeah, that's love it. I love all those examples and everything, because we even see it a lot of times with our students who are, you know, I'm even thinking of some, you know, very smart students, maybe high B, low A students even, but they're, yeah, all the time getting stuck at the first roadblock in a problem, right? And that's just like such a scarier thing to me, thinking about their future, than somebody who's, you know, getting D's or C's but is really like trying the problem over and over again, even if they're maybe completely off the map in terms of where they're actually going with it. it's the same back to your example. It's like, you know, oh, the person who can't calculate the tip at the table, right? Now, of course, I recognize there's a calculator in your pocket all the time now. There's tip calculator apps, any of that. So that's perfectly fine. I don't care if somebody can do 1.15 times their bill or 1.2 times their bill in their head. What I'm scared of is somebody who's afraid to try to do it. Does that make sense?
Huh. No, absolutely. I think that's a, and I think that's a bigger issue than just a math problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not, you know, I think that's well, that goes well beyond math into a problem that we all are all
for
facing.
Sure. And like the biggest thing we always, I remember seeing when I, you know, had the chance to manage a couple people, and now I manage a couple people in sort of the insurance business world. And now I manage, you know, we have almost 20 tutors on our team here. And, the biggest thing that you see with, and I was probably the same, to some extent when I started my career, the biggest mistake you see, I think, for young workers is that they sit down at their desk and they're told to do something by their boss. They get to that first problem, not sure, and they go back to the boss and ask. and that, of course, it's not directly related to do you know your unit circle, but it is that problem solving grit, work out, you know, work it around a couple different ways. Can we figure this out ourselves?
Yeah, I like that. And yeah, that's a good, that's a really good point. I think that is definitely something. And I like how that sort of ties back to the reward factor. Cause you're right. We don't properly reward the process. We're rewarding the finished product, the knowledge, the learning, whichever word you want to use. We're not rewarding the person that's trying and not quite getting there.
Exactly.
Do you feel like, and again, I think a lot of this is bigger problems than math, but do you feel like math teachers are maybe more guilty than that than others? And maybe that's why people are so often against math or intimidated by math?
Yeah. And it's interesting. My perspective has changed in this a little bit. Because I am still a big fan of being pretty decent at math is helpful, right? And I mean, it's a good skill to have. Probably because of those underlying problem solving skills and things like that, but it is very black and white for the most part, or at least the math we learn up until, you know, grade 10 or 11, it's pretty black and white. Here's the answer. That answer's right. That answer's wrong. So it does lean itself that way. And I, you know, I'm sort of saying all these ideas, but I don't know what a perfect evaluation system would look like when you're awarding hard work and not the final answer. Because it's tough. You already see people complain like, oh, I got the right answer. I just didn't show my work. That's the other side of the argument, right? It's like, well, I know how to get to the final answer. So what is the method even matter? So I can see where while they may be more guilty, I can totally see myself falling into the same trap.
Hmm. Well, and it's almost like, to me, that's almost a contradiction in that you're right. Math teachers want to see all the work. But it's not necessarily because they want to know how you arrived at the answer. It's that they're actually checking that every step along the way was right. In many cases, at least. Does that make sense in a paradigm difference?
Yeah, and that shouldn't be material.
Right. So if they're getting there, if they're working through the problem, even if they're working through it incorrectly, the recognition that, oh, okay, I see where you went wrong, then that should have value as well. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's how we're grading. I don't think that's why we're saying show your work. We're saying show your work because we want to make sure you were right multiple times, not just the final time.
Mm, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Do you obviously teach math then too? Do you have to teach a math class or not at all?
No, I don't teach math, thankfully. Okay. I don't think I could manage that. I don't think I could do that. You know, it's like one of those things you got to teach what you're passionate about. I could not in good conscience stand in front of a math class and go, this is going to be great, guys. Like, I just couldn't do that. I don't think I could manage it.
For sure. And I think you hit it. You mentioned passion there. I think that's that biggest struggle in the classroom where we're not rewarding hard work because – and then at graduation, we say, go follow your passion. And that makes no sense because I've just followed everybody else. I followed the, you know, the education curriculum up until here. Now I'm supposed to go follow my passion. I wanted to do that in grade school, but I was basically told not to. So I think that's the real challenge facing education sort of in this new world where you can be anything at basically any age because of the internet.
Yeah, I totally see that. And it's so funny to me because I look at it, I think sometimes I look at it in a retrospective kind of way. Like I think about if I had grown up with the technology that these kids have, if I had grown up in a one-to-one school, knowing how obsessed I was with a TI-86 that I was programming stuff in BASIC and did no pictures and no color and was like graphing only, pretty much graphing text and numbers. And I still did things that I was like, this is really cool. I was really proud of it. I can't even imagine what I would have done had you put a full-featured Windows laptop in front of me with an internet connection and access to social media. I'm both terrified and fascinated by what I would have done with that. Yeah. And yet my kids, my students in a one-to-one environment are barely scratching the surface of what they could be doing. And no one at the campus is pushing them to do more. And when I try to push like my specific kids, they're like, oh, this is just so hard.
Yeah. It's wow. That's interesting. And do you think that's because they've sort of that perseverance hasn't been fostered properly, maybe in the traditional classroom, or why do you think that is?
I've had a long running theory that the reason that they think everything is hard and are willing to give up so easily is because of the Xbox. And I don't mean video games in general, because I'm an avid gamer and have been my entire life. What I mean is I grew up and my first video game system was the original Nintendo, the NES. And you were lucky if your video games worked one out of every three times.
Totally.
And you would have to put the game in, then you'd have to like, it didn't work, you'd have to pull it out, you blow on the back end, you put it back in, you put like a sock halfway through so that it's only partway down but not all the way down, and then the sock, we had to refold the sock because it was too thick, and then partway through it stopped again, and you hoped you saved. And you had to struggle just to do one fun thing. Like there was effort involved in a basic fun thing. Now, if a kid's Xbox doesn't turn on, they just call Microsoft and say, hey, give me a new one. And Microsoft sends them a new one. Hmm. And that's not, I mean, that's good customer service on Microsoft's part, and that's great. And that's the advancement of technology by nature. But these kids don't know struggle. And that sounds like such an old man get off my lawn thing to say. But they don't, even in the most basic sense, they don't know struggle to getting to where they want to be. They just want it to work the first time. And I've equated that a lot to their use of technology in general, where they're just like, oh, it's broken. And I go, you just forgot your password. Like, it's not broken. You just don't remember your password. They're like, no, that's my password. I'm like, no, it's not. You're wrong. And they go, oh, okay. And like, it's like, that's the kind of experiences I have. So I think it goes further to that, in that they just, in a lot of cases, they didn't have to deal with struggle in small ways that we did early on, maybe, if that makes any sense.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I can get that for sure. But at the same time, while it's maybe not the same type of struggle where literally this thing doesn't work because everything works now, Instagram works every time, there is that struggle of like building a social media following that they're all excited to do and very passionate about, right? That they all have, and because nobody's struggling, maybe within that, it is a little bit of a battle because everyone has all of these followers, and how do you stand out from the crowd? And I think some of them do work towards doing that. It just might not be as frustrating
it's a different kind of struggle. Mm-hmm. I think you know, there's, because that is such a, like, so in a Nintendo, it's a very black and white, either the game works or it doesn't work.
Yep.
Right? Versus building a social media following is a very gray area. What do you define as a successful social media following? I mean, some of these kids have 200 followers and they think it's amazing and they're the most popular kid in school. And another kid might have 50 and feel the same way because they know every day they come to school and only have one friend. So, you know, that's such a relative struggle. It's a struggle almost self-created, that, or at least the success is self-created. So it's not quite the same. It's a bigger struggle almost in that way.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. But I do think there's, whether it's with a traditional math problem or not, I think you're exactly right. We have to find ways to get students not to stop at the first roadblock. I think that is the absolute, like, the biggest thing that education can be responsible for going forward.
Yeah. All right. Well, that may lead into sort of my second question for you, but and I appreciate you getting us back on math because I totally got lost in a Nintendo story there. So no, I appreciate that.
I can relate to it all. I remember Super Nintendo. I even remember Classic Nintendo as well.
Oh yeah, Classic Nintendo is what it was out. What it's all about. So my second question though is, what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do? And granted, you come from a slightly different perspective, but from your perspective, what is something you wish all teachers would do?
Okay. I will give one that I really took to heart in the classroom that I had at the university. And that is tone at the top, I would say. And this is for any sort of leadership position, I think, is that you have to drive the energy of the room. So I was teaching a course called interest theory, literally interest theory. Like it's a pretty dark topic, right? Financial mathematics, basically. But that doesn't mean you can't teach it in high energy, not use a PowerPoint and make sure you're talking to the students all the time. I always said that if a prof or one of my teachers has to use a PowerPoint or even notes, like actually copying off of notes, then they probably shouldn't be at the front of the class. And maybe that's a very cynical way of thinking of it, but I know that I took it as a point of pride to basically know the material inside and out. And this is difficult, high-level math material, but know it well enough that they could basically ask me any question, I'd be able to handle it and not just work on it myself, but actually solve it with them. So that all comes with, I think, bringing the highest level of energy or whatever energy you want the classroom to take on, you need to bring that to the class. And I, you know, for the most part, teachers probably do this. I just think it's easy on Friday before a long weekend to, you know, not maybe bring your best stuff, not prepare as best as possible, or the day before got away from you so you didn't have the notes perfectly laid out or whatever it might be. But I'm sure you could look back and look at those different lessons and see the change in the classroom dynamics because of that sort of tone at the top phrase that I always come back to in any sort of leadership position. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're 100% right. And not having a lot of experience at the college level, I can say from the school level, there are certainly teachers who do struggle with that. You know, they come at it from whatever tone they're maybe most comfortable with, and that isn't always the one that might be best for what they're doing. And it definitely, the ebbs and flows of a Friday, you know, before a long weekend kind of thing, I can completely agree with that and am guilty of it for sure, where it's just like, I am not feeling this today. And you're right. Often those are the worst behaved days where everything's going wrong, and it's because my energy level is off and that's what I'm projecting into the room. Mm-hmm. So certainly I can agree with that.
Yeah, certainly easier said than done.
Yeah, that's for sure. I don't think I can agree with the PowerPoint being a bad thing. I will say that it depends on how it's used. You know, for me, it's more of a guideline of like, oh, right, that's what I wanted to talk about next. You know, it's the reminder for my planning process, in many cases. And there's very few words on the slides. It's mostly just pictures, and it's really just a guideline for me to go, oh, right, what I wanted to talk about here was this. And then I begin to have a conversation, but it's that.
Perfect.
It's almost the anchor for me more than it is for the kids.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Same as if you had a small notepad with a few point form things on in front of you, for sure. Yep, totally.
Yeah, exactly.
All the
research on lecture says that's really the best way to do it, is having very little data or very little information on the slide itself, because people are just end up copying it and then they're not listening and everything else. So
yeah, exactly.
I can agree with that part of it at least.
Kind of like you would see at a TED talk. And then I would say at more of sort of the individual level, I just had one more idea, would be, that thing I kind of mentioned before, which is leave the math aside for as long as you can, especially if it's a student who you can tell they're just rushing to get the answer to finish their assignment and hand it in and then never have to look at it again. That's never going to be a good learning outcome. So if you can just chat with them about the concept, what they've, you'll get a better idea of where they're actually at, what they've understood from the lecture and what they haven't, and then you can go from there. And of course that's easier said than done, because you don't always get that individual time with every student, but when you do, I think if you can just chat the general concepts, see if they can explain it back to you in their own words, that's what we always talk with our staff and our team of tutors, is like, if they can explain the topic back to you, you've nailed it.
Good. Yeah, I think that's a definite, you know, it's a common metric for saying that learning has happened, is if they can teach it back, for sure. Cool. I like that. All right, let me do my last question, and then I have a feeling that's going to drive me into a couple more questions that have been driving me in the math realm, because I've always got math questions and no one to answer them, because I don't know, math people don't like to talk to me for some reason. I can't imagine why. I totally respect them and their profession. But my last question is, as always, who is the best teacher you ever had?
The best teacher I had was Dr. Chris Bomford, was his name. And I had the pleasure of learning math from him, grade 10, 11, and 12. So basically saw him every day of my high school. The high school I went to was just 10 to 12. And he, I think, was pretty inspiring because he, was very smart, first of all. And I think, at least for me and most of the students in the class, I could tell there was a level of respect there without it being, I think he sort of commanded respect without being condescending or rude at all. Like, very nice guy. But you could just tell he was one of those really smart people who got excited about teaching. So he was a PhD in physics, but came back to teach high school math. So I think just the way he sort of commanded a classroom, but then had a really brilliant gift of relating to individual students. You know, I think the student who was doing the poorest in our class at math, you know, had just as good a relationship with him as the students at the top of the class. And however he managed to do that, I'm not quite sure, but I think that would be the goal of, and it even touches on a lot of the things we've been talking about here today, is that that would be the goal of most teachers, is if you can really connect or relate to all 25 or 30 students.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of cool. I like that you got to have him follow with you. I think those are so critical, and is in my role, it's something I get to do with my students often, is have them, is follow with them for 2, 3, even 4 years as they get ready to graduate. And you know, those are the students who I know I can really teach. I could pretty much teach them whatever I wanted to, because I know them so well. I know what their learning styles are. I know what they need. And I think that's a really powerful system. I wish there was a way we could almost make that happen even in a larger environment, where I think there would be a lot of value in it.
No, that's so cool. Yeah, you basically get to do what you probably started teaching wanting to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's probably the reason a lot of people started teaching, is because they wanted to have that lasting impact and really unlock a child's brain. And you get to do that with when you follow through with them, I imagine, a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are my kids. You know what I mean? Like, they're my kids. Interestingly, my son is only 5, so they've been my kids almost as long as my actual son has. So, you know, it's crazy to me that, you know, the relationships you're able to build and have with, and just the connections and the proud moments where I'm just so proud of them. So yeah, I think that's a really powerful experience to have been able to have. And I can see how that would lend itself to being one of your best teacher, for sure.
I think the other great thing about, one last thing about being able to follow through with students, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that can work nicely for that, like, problem solving perseverance side of things for the student, because while I would never wish it upon any student to hate their teacher for 3 years straight, it does give that sense of the real world. You know, you can't always pick your team members in your job or your role or your career. So how are you going to adapt your, in that case, learning style or problem solving skills to work with somebody who you maybe don't naturally jive with? I think there can be some lessons gained there that students probably wouldn't realize at first, but it probably is a good insight into the real world.
Very cool. Can you think of like a specific lesson or a specific life lesson or concept that you got from Dr. Bumford that, you know, just has always resonated with you or always stuck with you across time?
Wow, that's a good question.
I know, I kind of threw that one at you completely unprepared for it.
I think I would say this. I would say we're an advanced math class, and I think because a lot of me and my friends were probably go-getters or keeners maybe in the math class. I heard that term dropped on your show a couple of guests ago.
Yep. Sarah told me what a keener is, so I got that one.
Right.
I know that one.
So because I'm probably guilty of that, at least in the math class, and we would always be, you know, excited, or maybe even we were sort of always worried. It was this big, big thing. And he was very good at calming us down, saying, look, this is just like anything else you've accomplished. If you were to look back in grade 10 and say, oh, I'm never going to learn, the unit circle, or I'm never going to learn limits in calculus, you know, you would have been wrong, because ultimately you get there, you work hard, you practice, and you can accomplish that. So he said, just like anything else, this exam's the same thing. It's no big, scary monster. And God, I remember us all getting into sort of the right frame of mind to actually write that. And that's something I carry forward all the time. We do an exam prep seminar for one of the for a provincial exam here in the province of Manitoba in Canada. So every grade 12 student has to write the same exam. And because of that, it is thought of as this big, scary monster and all this pressure, and you're going to be compared to everyone. But we always make a point at the seminar of saying, okay, look, this is just another math exam. We've seen tons of these questions in the past. When you see these questions, you're going to ask yourself these questions and you're going to be just fine. So I think a level of like calm confidence is sort of what he taught us well.
I can see that. And that definitely kind of goes back to your own point about overtaking the challenge and the struggle, is like you approach it with that confidence and you find a way to get through it instead of getting hung up on that roadblock.
For so. Sure. Yeah. Even approaching it, expecting the roadblocks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I also like that you guys say, and I haven't noticed it as much on Voice Ed, but you say, write the test. You guys say, write the test. Which we say take the test. You take the test or you complete the test. We don't say write the test. Writing the test is what the teacher does. The teacher writes the test. The student takes the test.
Oh, wow. I see that.
Yeah. I don't know that I haven't noticed that before with all my other Canadian guests. I think you're the first one that maybe has said it just more because of the nature of our conversation, but.
Maybe. So. I don't know what I would say when I was the professor. I created the tests, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, but cool. I love my Canadian family now. I feel like the Voice Ed guys are, the guys and girls are my Canadian family. So if I ever am in Canada, I feel like I have lots of places I can stay. That's really the point. So, you know, you hit on something that is really not the point of my podcast, but has been a driving question for me for over a year. Maybe not over a year, but about a year ago, I set a project for my students and I told them the project for that week or the next 2 weeks was to teach me something. And what I told them was they needed to teach me something. It needed to be something I didn't already know. They needed to have a lesson. They needed to have a practice activity and then some sort of formative monitoring to see if I had actually learned what they intended for me to learn. And one of my particularly math-minded students decided it would be a good idea to teach me calculus limits. And
wow.
He was in calculus at the time, and his calculus teacher, one of the teachers at our school, is a legend. I mean, he's phenomenal. His AP Calc pass rate is somewhere in the 76% percentile. I mean, it's unbelievable, which is like ridiculously high compared to anyone else in our area. So he's a great teacher. But this student decided they would teach me calc. And I said, you don't want to do that. And he said, no, I do. It'll be totally fine. I'm like, I promise it won't be. And it turns out it's not. And the question I kept asking him and he could not answer is, why on earth would I need to find the limit of something? What does that even mean? How does that apply in any way to reality? And what the heck is it? And that's so you mentioned calc limits. Wow. And I just have to ask because I have no idea what they are.
The student couldn't answer.
He showed me how to do them. Obviously, I don't remember any of it because it's math and it's boring, but he showed me how to do it, but I could not, for the life of me, come up with a reason why. He's like, I don't know, Shrift, just do it. I'm like, okay,
fine. Oh, amazing. Okay. So you want me to take a shot at that?
Yeah, what is the point of a calculus limit? What does that even mean?
Oh, that's great. So here's what I would say is, let's say you're driving from city A to city B, and it is a 200-mile distance, okay? And let's say it takes you 2 hours to get there. How fast did you drive?
Okay, so it's 200 miles, and it took me 2 hours. Is that what you said?
Correct.
I'm writing the numbers down. All right, so then okay. It would be 60 minutes times 2, which is 120 minutes.
You can give it to me in miles per hour, even. I'll make it easy for you.
Okay, miles per hour, I had to have driven 100 miles an hour then.
Very good, very good. So you drove 100 miles an hour to get there, right?
Yep.
However, you probably backed out of your driveway at first and drove slowly down the block and then had to merge onto the freeway, and maybe on the freeway you had to stop for gas. And okay, so we would call that 100 miles an hour sort of an average speed over that period of time?
Right.
Okay, so now... And how did we get that average? We basically took your end distance minus your beginning distance, so 200 miles, over your end time minus your beginning time, 2 hours, right? And we divided that?
Yeah.
So that was like an average rate of change of 100 miles an hour. Now, what do you do if you want to narrow that distance? So I don't care over the whole 2 hours, but I care, say, between times 0.5 and time 1, I want to know, on average, how fast are you going? Well, you would do the same thing. You'd figure out how much distance you covered over half an hour, and you'd divide, right?
Right.
And let's say you keep narrowing that time. Eventually, you're going to get to a point where you're not moving from one time to the next time. It's just at a certain time. So if I asked you, okay, when you were halfway through your journey, so 1 hour into your journey, at that point, exactly how fast you were going, we can't use that same formula of the subtraction and the division. We have to take the limit of that change in time as that goes to zero.
So limit is when something, it has to, because like now this is kind of sounding familiar as you're putting it that way. Like it had something to do with something approaching zero. That sounds right.
Yep. And it doesn't have to be zero, but that's the best example, I think, is that okay. if we're measuring your change in distance over a particular time, it's easy to do it when it's between two points in time. But when we want to just know your speed, which is your change in distance with respect to time, if we want to know exactly how fast are you going 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 30 seconds into your drive, that's only one point in time. So we want that instantaneous rate of change. So what we're doing is taking the limit as the change in time goes to zero.
And so the limit effectively tells me what at that point? What is it? Because it's not really telling me speed, because I don't have speed.
It will tell you speed. It will tell you the change in distance as it relates to time at that one point, which will be a speed. Okay. So it might end up being at that point you were going 130 miles an hour, let's say, at that one point. But the way we found that was we said, okay, well, what if that change in time approaches zero? And that's what a limit is it's not saying... it doesn't care about it at a particular point. It says, as we get really, really close to that particular point, what's your speed going? So you can think of it as almost if you were watching your speedometer, as you approached one particular time, boom, at that point, what would it say? and that's your speed at that point.
Okay, that's a significantly better example than he gave me. He gave me the example of just zero. He didn't actually know, so he just didn't give me an example. So that doesn't even count. But I think your example kind of makes sense to me, I guess. And okay. I guess I just still don't get math. I think at the end of the day, I just don't get math.
No, you would get it. You would get it.
Well, Mike, I really appreciate you talking to me. We're coming up on an hour here, so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. This has been a great conversation. I really do appreciate it. For someone who is a math person, I feel like I didn't completely scare you off my show. So that's a good thing.
Not at all. Thanks so much for having me. And I would love to hear any listener feedback too, so they can always feel free to tweet at me or contact through you or however you want to do it.
And if you could, what is your Twitter account? What's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Sure. So they can tweet us at ATNow. So that's the name of our math tutoring app. And they can check that out on the apps.
Cool. Very cool. Well, I encourage them to do that, because if you can even remotely explain limits to me over a podcast, I'm fairly certain you guys do a great job of tutoring your students. But I really appreciate you sitting with me, and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks again.
Thanks again to Mike for talking to me and for putting up with all my math insults. Numbers stink. If, like me, you struggle with math or want another resource to make available to your students, check out Arnold Tutoring's ATNow app. You can get more details at atnowapp.com, that's with two P's, or reach out to Mike on Twitter, that's @ATNowApp, again, two P's. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm @BradStreffler. I love to hear from you guys, and that's also a great place to connect if you, like Mike, would like to be a guest on the show. Until next week, remember that you don't need permission from anyone to start anything. Music for this podcast is provided by Kevin MacLeod and is the song Vicious, licensed under Creative Commons. This show is also a proud member of the Voice Ed Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. Your voice belongs here.